Questions of Faith, Lecture 3, The Problem of Evil.
The problem of evil is one of the most important of all questions in the philosophy of religion, for at least three reasons. First, it's universal. Everyone wonders why bad things happen to good people. Second, it's not just an intellectual problem. It's an existential problem, a concrete human problem. It's not just about whether the two concepts of God and evil can be logically thought together without contradiction, but also about whether the lived experience of evil and the lived choice of religious faith in God can exist together in life. Third, it's the strongest argument for atheism. In fact, the only one that claims to prove with certainty that God cannot possibly exist. For the theist, evil's a problem. For the atheist, it's a proof. For both, it's an argument. We need to first formulate the argument, then explain it, then evaluate it. Here are four ways to formulate the argument. The first is the simplest. If one of two opposites is infinite, the other cannot exist. But God means infinite goodness. So if God existed, then God's opposite, evil, could not exist. Evil does exist. Therefore, God does not. Here's a second way, essentially the same product, but a little more unpacked. If God exists, he's both totally good and totally powerful. God means a being whose goodness and power are unlimited. Now, if God is all good, he would will only good and not evil. And if God is all powerful, he would attain everything that he willed. Therefore, if God existed, everything would be good. Not everything is good. Some things are evil. Therefore, God does not exist. Here's a third formulation, which focuses on subjective human happiness instead of objective goodness. If God is all good, he loves us. And if he loves us, he wants us to be happy. And if he's all powerful, he can get everything he wants. But we are not happy. Therefore, God lacks either goodness or power or both. If God exists, he is either bad or weak, and that's not God. These first three formulations are all very clear, very simple, and very powerful. It may surprise you to learn that they were first formulated not by atheists, but by theists. The first comes from St. Thomas Aquinas, the second from St. Augustine, and the third from C.S. Lewis. Here's a fourth formulation of the argument. This is the one most philosophers today like to use. It is logically impossible that all four of the following propositions are true. If any three of them are true, the fourth one must be false. First, God exists. Second, God is all good, or omnibenevolent. Third, God is all powerful, or omnipotent. Fourth, evil exists. Let's work this out. If God exists and he's all good and all powerful, then evil cannot exist. If God exists and is all good, but evil exists too, then God is not all powerful. If God exists and he's all powerful, but evil exists, then God is not all good. And finally, if God means a being that is all good and all powerful, and yet evil exists, then such a God cannot exist. And those seem to be the only four logically possible alternatives. The first alternative, denying that evil really exists, well, this may be non-dualist Hinduism or Buddhism or Mary Baker Eddy's Christian Science or New Age philosophy, but it's not theism. It's also logically self-contradictory, for if evil is an illusion, then the fact that we fear this illusion is a real evil and not an illusory one. If our fear of evil is groundless, then that very fear is evil. The second alternative, denying that God is all-powerful, is really polytheism, which believes in many gods, with none of them having all the power. A modern version of that is process theology, which says God is in process in time, and he's not yet fully grown up into total power. He's a sort of a teenage god. Well, that too is not traditional theism. The third alternative, denying that God is all good, Well, that's basically the theology of the Star Wars trilogy, that the Force has a dark side, that good and evil, God and the devil, are two sides of the same being. Well, that may be Hinduism. Brahman manifests itself equally as both Vishnu the creator and Shiva the destroyer, but that's certainly not traditional theism. It's more like pantheism, the belief that God is everything and everything is God, evil as well as good. But pantheism is not theism. Theism says God is not everything. He's the transcendent creator of everything. But the only other alternative, the fourth one, is atheism, the denial not of evil or of God's goodness or of God's power, but of God's real existence. Now, how have theists tried to answer this problem? It seems unsolvable. Well, there's only five ways anyone can ever respond to any argument. So let's review a little logic and classify these five possible ways first before we listen to the theist's way. The number five is based on the essential structure of all logical argument. Any argument tries to prove its conclusion by reasoning from premises. And the conclusion and the premises are propositions that are composed of terms. That's why there are these three checkpoints for any argument: the terms, the premises, and the reasoning process. What can go wrong with the terms? Some kind of ambiguity, so that what seems to be one term is really two, and we don't really know what we're talking about. For instance, if I argue that banks are safe places to keep money in, and riverbanks are banks, therefore riverbanks are safe places to keep money in, I'm using the term banks ambiguously. What can go wrong with the premises? Simply, they can be false. You can prove anything from false premises. For instance, you can say, anyone who can write philosophy books is a god, and I can write philosophy books, therefore I am a god. What can go wrong with the reasoning process? Well, it can commit logical fallacies, so the conclusion doesn't logically follow from the premises. For instance, I can argue, all men are mortal, and all rats are mortal, therefore all men are rats. So, here are the five things you can say to any argument. You can deny its conclusion because you find in the argument an ambiguous term, or you can deny the conclusion because you find in the argument a false premise, or you can deny the conclusion because you find in the argument a logical fallacy, or the fourth possibility is that the argument passes all three of those checkpoints and therefore proves its conclusion to be true and you admit it, you agree. Well, what's the fifth answer? Unfortunately, it's given very often. You can say the argument has proved its conclusion to be true, but you don't agree because you simply want to be stupid and stubborn and pig-headed and say things like, well, that may be true for you, but not for me, which is simply meaningless. But it makes you feel safe against an argument that you don't like an ostrich sticking its head in the ground so it doesn't see its enemy that's coming to kill it. Now, I hope that none of you, atheist or theist, wants to choose that fifth possibility. And theists certainly don't want to choose the fourth possibility because that's atheism. So they have to choose one of the first three possibilities. But there is no logical fallacy in any of the four formulations of the argument, so that leaves only two possibilities: to show that some premise isn't true or that some term is used ambiguously. But all the premises seem obviously true in some sense. And if they're not true in some other sense, then what we have is two different senses, and that means ambiguity. So all the answers to the problem of evil come down to claiming to find an ambiguous term. They explore the terms more deeply, and they criticize the atheist for not using his terms correctly, not seeing what the terms really mean. So let's explore how that might be done. There are six important terms in the argument: God, exists, evil, good, powerful, and happy. So there are basically six ways that theists have tried to answer the argument. First, about God. They've said, we don't really understand God or God's mind. We've been arguing about God's goodness and power. We've forgotten a third attribute, his wisdom. It might be that God sees what we don't see, how apparent evil really works out for our greater good and our greater happiness in the end. And that's why he allows evil. That's what the New Testament says. God works everything together for good for those who love him. But we couldn't possibly understand how he does that because we're not God. That's basically what God said to Job when he appeared and gave Job his answer at the end of that book, the most famous book in the world about the problem of evil. God's answer to Job's impatient question was essentially, "Hush, child, you couldn't possibly understand." Now, that answer is certainly not satisfying to our natural curiosity because it doesn't explain evil. But it does explain why we can't explain it. So, although it's not satisfying, it is logically consistent. If God did exist, then our human mind would have to be more inferior to God's mind than a baby chick's mind is inferior to our mind. We would be players in the great drama, and he the writer. We are foot soldiers in the battle, and he's the general. What would count against the existence of God would be if there weren't any such mysteries. That would seem to indicate that we were the highest mind, that there was not a divine mind higher than ours. The theist can go even further and argue that the very problem of evil that leads many minds to atheism shows that atheism can't be the right answer to it, because the problem of evil assumes that evil is real and really bad, and that assumes that our judgment of it is true, and that assumes that we are in touch with some real standard of goodness when we are outraged at an evil like the undeserved suffering of an innocent child. And a real standard of goodness, not just a subjective thought or desire of feeling inside our own mind, well, where is that? What is that? It's suspiciously like the mind or will of God. If good and evil were only our own feelings, we'd have no right to our outrage at God. We wouldn't be saying, "How dare you run the universe so badly?" We'd only be saying, "I don't personally like the way you run the universe. It doesn't make me feel good." But then we'd have no logical argument against God, because we wouldn't be talking about a real fact that really proves that God doesn't exist, like the real injustice in letting that child be harmed. We'd only be talking about our own private feelings. Now, this real standard of good that we have to be in touch with when we judge that the world is too full of evils to be compatible with God, what kind of goodness does that have to be? It has to be perfect goodness, not imperfect goodness. A teacher judges one exam paper as deserving a B and another one as deserving a C only because she uses the standard of a straight A. A real 85% and a real 75% make sense only relative to a real 100%, whether anybody ever gets 100 or not. But this is an argument for the reality of perfect goodness, which is one of the things God is. Only God is perfect. So, the theist argues, the problem of evil really seems to argue for God, if you trace back its assumptions. The second possibly ambiguous term is exist or existence. The atheist's answer to the argument I just gave would be that the theist is using the term exists ambiguously. The atheist would say, valid standards of true judgment don't exist as stones and people exist. So the theist can't prove that God exists just by showing that the atheist is presupposing a real standard of perfect goodness. And that brings us to the ambiguity of the term exists. And the theist replies that the atheist is committing this fallacy of ambiguity when he argues that God can't exist because evil exists. The atheist argues that if God is the creator of all things, then he is the creator of ill things. But the theist can reply, there are no ill things. All things are good. Evil is not an existing thing. Not all our actions are good, not all our choices are good, but all things are good. God creates things. We create actions and choices. If I do an evil deed, like cutting off your head, I have to have a good intelligence and a good arm and a good knife to do that evil deed. There's no evil stuff, even stuff that's inconvenient to me, like mosquitoes, or worse than inconvenient, like cancer cells. That's not evil stuff. It's good stuff, though it's not morally good. But it's real and present and strong and alive, and it's good to be all those things. The only things that can be morally good or evil are free choices by persons. But those aren't things God created, because they're not things, and because God didn't create them, we did. A third potentially ambiguous term is the term evil. We just distinguished two very different kinds of evil: moral evils, like the choice to murder you by cutting your head off, and physical evils, like the suffering and death in your body that my knife would cause, and also the suffering and death in the cancer cell that radiation causes. You see, these examples show that physical goods are often in competition. In order to save some physical goods, like human bodies, we have to kill others, like cancer cells. But we judge that to be a morally good act. So we judge moral goodness and evil very differently than we judge physical goods and evils. So since there are two kinds of evil, there are really two problems of evil, not just one. The theist's answer to the atheist's question why God would allow moral evil is human free will. But that doesn't answer the question why God allows physical evils. God doesn't create moral evil, we do. God isn't responsible for moral evil any more than we're responsible for our children's bad choices. We're responsible for the existence of our children and for all the things we teach them and do for them. But even if all those things are good, our children can still make evil choices because they have free will and they're not just our puppets. And that analogy is apt because theists don't call God our puppeteer in heaven, but many call him our Father in heaven. But the remaining problem of physical evil is still there. It's less of a problem than moral evil because the worst human suffering comes from moral evil. Just think, if everybody in the world was morally perfect, if we were all saints, how would that transform the world? I think we'd have joy from pole to pole. The worst evils are the ones we do to each other. Our worst sufferings aren't caused by things, but by people. And first of all, by the one we see in the mirror. We certainly harm the earth much more than it harms us, and we harm animals more than they harm us. But physical evils are still problems. How could a totally good God create a world with any physical evil in it? The simplest answer to that is to ask what else he could do. If he's going to create a finite world at all, it's got to have limits, limited physical goodness. If no living things ever died, there wouldn't be room for others to be born. If we never experienced pain, we wouldn't appreciate pleasure. And we wouldn't be able to develop the higher goods of courage and sympathy. Perfect utopian painless worlds in fantasy or science fiction stories are almost always unlivable, unendurably boring, and inhuman worlds. As that great philosopher Yogi Berra once said, "If the world were a perfect place, it wouldn't be." The atheist argues, if I were God, I would have created a world with less physical evils in it. And the theist can reply, yes, so would I, and that's why it's very fortunate that neither of us is God. There are still further questions here. There always are. The atheist may ask the theist whether he believes there will be pains in heaven, and if not, then God can create a perfect world without any physical pains, so why didn't he create this one that way? A fair question. The theist may reply in three ways. First, he may say God did create a perfect world, a Garden of Eden, and we messed it up. Perhaps things like thorns and thistles were not painful to us until we set ourselves against the whole natural order when we set ourselves against God. Maybe God is more present to that order of nature than we think. Or, second, you could say that we will appreciate the perfect world of heaven more if we experience imperfections here first. No one in the history of sports was ever happier than Red Sox fans in 2004. Or, third, that the perfect world is perfectly ours only if we freely choose it, and that requires a trial of free choice. The point of these replies is not to close the debate, but to keep it open, so that both choices, theism and atheism, remain real live options. In fact, that's the point of these lectures. And that seems to have been God's point, too, if God exists, for he did not suppress the evidence for either side. He left enough good in the world to puzzle the atheist and enough evil to puzzle the theist, so that both choices can be free and intelligent choices, not compulsions like math equations, where we have no freedom. A fourth potentially ambiguous term is goodness. How can God be good if he allows so many evils? Maybe our last answer gives us a clue. The best analogy we have to think about the divine person is human persons. The theist claims that God created us in his own image, with intelligence and free will. Of course, if God exists, he must be much more than us, but he's more like us than he is like an animal or a plant or a planet or a number. So let's look for some analogies in human life. What is a good human person? Is it one who never allows others to do or suffer any evil? Parents who don't let their kids fail, who do their homework for them, who teach them not to take chances because they might get hurt? Certainly not. That might be kindness, but goodness is more than kindness. Kindness may be enough for strangers. It's not enough for those we love. If you see some stranger doing something stupid, like taking drugs, you probably shake your head and walk away and say, "Poor fool." You don't make trouble. You're kind and tolerant and non-judgmental. But if you see your kids getting hooked on drugs, you're much less kind, less tolerant. You interfere. You make trouble for them because you love them more, not less. Tolerance is not love. It's a substitute for love. Look at the difference between grandparents and parents. Grandparents play with their grandchildren. Parents live with their children. That's why most kids enjoy their grandparents much more than their parents. They're kinder. Parents keep interfering. Grandparents say, "Go out and have a good time." Parents say, "Wait, be sure not to do this and not to do that." If the theistic hypothesis claimed that there is a God who is simply kind and tolerant like a grandfather, that would be logically inconsistent with human suffering. But the theistic hypothesis, the picture of God that the biblical theist gives us, is that God is more like a father than like a grandfather. Or even more, in the words of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, God is not nice. God is not an uncle. God is an earthquake. This analogy of a parent might explain why God allows moral evils as well as physical evils. It's for love. When we love someone a lot, we put a very high value on their freedom. Romeo will not put Juliet in a sack and carry her off. He asks her, "Do you love me?" and waits for her free choice, her free love. And apparently God does the same to us. Now, all these theistic answers don't prove the atheist is wrong, but they do give an answer, and one that respects the atheist's own values of goodness and love and freedom. The issue of the relation between suffering and God is not just a logical problem. It cuts deep into the very essence of religion. One of the saints says, "The cross is the gift God gives to his friends. The sculptor takes the most trouble with his masterpieces, and he makes the most trouble for them. The chisel falls again and again." Well, if we look at the saints as the clearest examples of what religion is supposed to do for us, we'll see that they all suffer a lot, and unjustly, but willingly, out of their love and their faith. They say that's God's design, to strengthen and toughen them against anything this world can throw at them, and at the same time make them softer and more pliable to God, to make them surrender or submit in trust, not because they see for themselves by their own reason, but out of faith, and thus they accept what seems irrational and dark and mysterious. And not because that religious attitude pays off in terms of earthly happiness and peace and success, whether it does or not, but the motive is simply that that's God's will, and that's the supreme good of the saint, not their own will, not their autonomy. Eastern religions don't usually speak of the will of God, but they too see sacrifice and suffering as necessary, because that ego has to be kicked off the throne of our lives, even when the God of Western religions doesn't step onto the throne. So suffering is not an accident. It's part of a religious package deal, part of the pattern, the plan, the divine design. It's not part of the problem, it's part of the solution. You may be surprised that we've moved from syllogisms to suffering, from assessing the strength of logical arguments pro and con to trying to understand the spirituality of the saints. You may be wondering, is this still the philosophy of religion? My answer is it most definitely is, if philosophy is the love of wisdom, and if wisdom aims to give us a clear vision of things so we can make our judgments in that light, so if we're doing the philosophy of religion, we'd better be clear about what religion claims and offers before we judge it, either theoretically or practically. That is, before we judge whether to believe it or not, and before we judge whether to try to live it or not. Or we might choose the third option, something between the yes and the no. We might decide to believe only the clear and obvious things in it, the profound platitudes that we believed already, the generic things every religion teaches, but not to believe the mysterious and controversial and surprising things that any particular religion teaches. We might also choose to say neither yes nor no on the practical level. We might choose to dabble, to practice it only when it doesn't cost much, to get our feet wet, to use it to cool our hot feet or clean our dirty feet, but that's all, because it's like an ocean with big waves in it, and it's scary to go out too far where we might lose our footing. But that's what every religion demands, that we lose our footing, not just rationally by believing things we can't prove, but also personally, existentially, by losing our egotism and autonomy, and by embracing suffering and sacrifice. That's what every religion demands. So this third alternative is not quite honest. It does not confront the demand and say either yes or no. Well, back to our logic. A fifth term that might be ambiguous in the problem of evil is the term all-powerful. If God can do anything, then he could create a finite world with free will in it and guarantee that there would be no evil in it, couldn't he? If he can do this and doesn't, then he's not as good as he could be. And then he's not God. Most theists, like Augustine and Aquinas and C.S. Lewis, answer, no, he can't. Just as he can't make a rock bigger than he can lift. Because there can be no such thing. It's a meaningless self-contradiction to create free choice and to guarantee that no one will ever freely choose evil. God could perform miracles, but not contradictions. Because contradictions are nothing at all. They are our mental mistakes. Creatures with free will but unable to choose evil is a meaningless set of words. So is a finite, limited world without any finite limitations to its goodness. The theist can ask the atheist, if you were God and able to do anything, what would you do differently? Would you not create any world at all? If you do create a world, it's got to be dependent on you, so it's less than you, so it's finite. So there's limits to its goodness. Would you create a world with no life in it so that there would be no pain? But then there'd be no pleasure either. Would you create animals but not humans? Well, zoos are great, but families are better. Would you keep your kids safe and happy by protecting them all the time? Well, then if you're God, you'd have to zap them with a frontal lobotomy or a mystical experience every time their brains started to think evil thoughts. That's putting Juliet in a sack and carting her away. Love values freedom, because love has to be free. I think there's no way for us to prove which kind of world would be better, because all the standards we use to judge anything are taken from our existing world and ourselves. We just don't have the divine point of view of all possible worlds before any worlds are created. But I also think that even the atheist is glad that we have this world rather than no world, or a dead world, or an unfree world. So even the atheist believes in God's values, even if he doesn't believe in God. The sixth and final ambiguous term is happiness. If God is all good, why aren't we happy? The theist can answer, because we're in time, in a drama, a story. And we will be happier in the end if we go through some unhappiness now. We water the plant of our own happiness with our own tears. St. Teresa of Avila says, when we look back at the most terrible earthly sufferings from the viewpoint of heaven, we will say they were no more than one night in an inconvenient hotel. That saying may sound outrageous to us when we're mourning over the death of a loved one. But it may also sound hopeful, in fact, our only hope in terrible suffering. And is there anything logically inconsistent in it? If it were true, it would explain why we can't explain our sufferings. We are in that hotel all the time, and it's all we know, and we take it terribly seriously. We're like a 3-year-old who just dropped her favorite ice cream cone onto the street. It's the biggest pleasure she can imagine, and it's gone. And she's outraged that her parents don't take her tears seriously enough. Now, can we be sure that we are older and wiser than that 3-year-old compared to God? And if you answer yes, I recommend that you read Socrates and first learn the secular wisdom of humility before tackling religious questions about God. But the hardest form of the problem of evil we still haven't confronted. That's injustice, the unjust distribution of suffering. Why does it happen to people who don't deserve it? The problem is not just why bad things happen, or even why so many bad things happen. How many is too many? How could we draw the line? But why they happen to good people, and why they happen randomly. The theist could reply, there are no good people. The real problem is why so many good things happen to bad people. If you get a dozen roses that you don't deserve, do you complain about their thorns? Atheists often complain that religion makes you arrogant and self-righteous. Isn't it the essence of arrogance and self-righteousness to assume that you are good people? Well, that's a very hard question to answer. What standard do you use to judge human goodness? God's standards, but that presupposes God and thus begs the question. Human standards, do you judge good and bad by the average human life, but that begs the question the other way. The theist believes that that average is now very bad and not a fair standard, that our whole species has fallen into moral insanity. Should we judge saints by sinners' standards or sinners by saints' standards? The saints all say we are bad, but the saints are the best and happiest people in the world, so don't they have some authority? If you doubt that the saints are the happiest people in the world, why don't you investigate your data? Go to your city's worst slum and visit Mother Teresa's Missionaries of Charity. Judge for yourself.
This ends Lecture 3. Questions of Faith, Lecture 4. Arguments for God's Existence from Nature.
We spent most of the last two lectures examining the case for atheism in 20 arguments. We will spend this lecture and the next examining the case for theism, also in 20 arguments. But where in our experience could we look for the evidence for God's existence? Where are there divine fingerprints? In two possible places. All human experience has two poles, the subject and the object, the within and the without, the self and the universe. In this lecture, we will summarize the 10 most famous arguments from Evidence in the Objective World, or Nature, or the Universe, or the Cosmos. They're called cosmological arguments. In the next lecture, we'll look at the 10 most popular arguments from the Inner World, or psychological arguments. Arguments are labeled by their premises. All 20 of our arguments for atheism had the same conclusion that God does not exist, but they argued from 20 different premises, which were divided into different kinds. Similarly, all 20 of our arguments for theism will have the same conclusion that God does exist, but they argue from 20 different premises, divided into two different kinds, inner and outer, or psychological and cosmological. The first five cosmological arguments are the famous five ways of Thomas Aquinas. They all begin with empirical data, not specific things like a planet or a person, but general features of the whole universe, like time and change. And then they argue that if there is no God, these features are unexplainable, that God is the only sufficient reason or adequate explanation for these data. So the method of argument is essentially scientific. Test hypotheses by data and choose the hypothesis that best explains all the data. Now, not one of these arguments claims to prove all that religious people mean by God. Each argument claims to prove only that some being exists that has at least one uniquely divine attribute, one perfection that, by definition, only God can have. The unmoved mover, the uncaused cause, the necessary being, the intelligence behind design. But that would be enough to disprove atheism. I think at least some of the popular arguments for theism are not just weak, but simply fallacious. I think some of the arguments for atheism are fallacious, too. But only one argument is needed for either side. If either side can put out a single argument with no ambiguous terms, no false premises, and no logical fallacy, then its conclusion would be proved to be true. The atheist argues that all the theist's arguments have at least one of these mistakes and can be answered, and that at least one of the atheist's arguments is unanswerable, probably the argument from evil. The theist argues that all the atheist's arguments are answerable, and at least one of the theist's arguments is unanswerable. It takes only one certain fingerprint or one certain piece of DNA to prove the presence of a suspect. The first argument is the argument from change. The most universal feature of all our experience is time. Even our mind is in time, though it's not in space like our body. It takes time to think. Everything, both matter and mind, changes, whether quickly or slowly. Now, either there is or there is not some real being that does not change. That would be a divine attribute. That's a pretty thin slice of God, so to speak, but it would be enough to disprove atheism and prove some sort of God, some eternal, unchangeable being that is not part of the universe because everything in the universe changes, moves in some way. This unchanging being could be the cause of all change, the explanation for all change, and nothing else could. The argument is simple. The first premise is, if there is no unmoved mover, no unchanged changer, then there could not be any second movers, or any movement at all. The second premise is there is movement, so the conclusion is, therefore, there must be this first mover. Now, no one denies the second premise. So it's the first one that the atheist will deny. How can the theist try to prove that if there is no unmoved mover, there can't be any moved movers? By the fact that change works by the principle of cause and effect. Each change requires a changer, a cause. Imagine a long row of dominoes, each one knocking the next one down. Each event is a cause and effect relationship. The knocker is the cause, and the knockdown is the effect. No domino can knock itself down. The potentiality or possibility of being knocked down resides in each domino, and also the potentiality or possibility of standing upright and not being knocked down. So something has to determine which of those two possibilities becomes actual, and that's the other domino, which causes the knockdown, thereby making actual the change that was only potential before it was knocked down. Now, no matter how many dominoes are in the row, and no matter how long it takes from the first event to the last, that's the way causality works. If there's no cause, there's no effect. And if the second event is the effect of the first event, there can be no second without a first, and no third or fourth or anything else. In other words, no change anywhere without an absolutely first changer, first mover. But an absolutely first mover would not be another domino, which had to be first pushed by a domino before it, and only then it could push down the next domino. That would not make it the first domino. So a first mover would have to be outside the whole chain, like the finger that pushes the first domino down. It's not another domino, but another kind of being, outside the chain of dominoes. But that chain of dominoes is the whole universe. So the first mover must be outside the universe. Now, of course, it can't be literally outside the universe, in some place outside the universe, because the universe is the sum total of all places and all space, as well as all time. So this being would have to be more than the universe and not in space or time at all. But why couldn't the chain be infinitely long, with no first domino at all? because then nothing could begin. Change is not like the number series. There can be an infinite regress of negative numbers just as much as an infinite progress of positive numbers. But there can't be an infinite regress of causes of change with no first event, even though there could be an infinite progress into the future with no last event. Even before Big Bang cosmology proved that time is finite and has an absolute beginning about 15 billion years ago, philosophers came to the same conclusion by an analysis of the essential meaning of change. Numbers are timeless concepts. They're not events in time. But concrete events happen in time, in chains of causal dependence. If no first event, no second, no matter how many seconds there may be. If there's no locomotive, the train doesn't move, no matter how many cars are in the train. Now, if the first event has no cause at all, if the Big Bang has no Big Banger, then we have something utterly unscientific as well as irrational. The whole universe popped into existence out of nothing for absolutely no reason whatsoever. Nothing caused that event. It just happened. Nothing could be more unscientific than that. Let's call that the pop theory, that something can just pop into existence without any cause or reason at all. If we believed that, we'd just say, thunder happens, and not look for any cause of it. That would be far more irrational than believing that thunder is caused by an angry, irrational god named Zeus whom no one can see. That's a silly answer, but it's at least some cause, which could be checked out and argued about and disproved, and that would help us to find a better answer, like electrical storms. So even belief in Zeus is more scientific than the pop theory. This old argument has been made stronger by two developments in science. Astrophysics, which has proved that the universe has a beginning, that the amount of time is finite, and Einsteinian relativity, which has proved that there is no Newtonian absolute time, but that time is relative to matter in motion. So there can be no time before the Big Bang, the first event. But every event needs a cause, and the cause must be adequate to produce its effect. A little banger can't bang out a Big Bang. And that cause can't be just some abstraction like a mathematical equation or some theory like string theory or chaos theory. You need more than a pattern or formula or theory to explain actual concrete events. Roadmaps aren't enough to explain accidents. You need cars or trains. Ethics isn't enough to explain saints or sinners. You need people making moral choices. The principles of economics aren't enough to explain why money comes to me from my investments. Unless I or somebody else puts actual money in, I'm not going to get any actual money out. So, if the first event has a cause, it must be real and adequate to explain the effect. But the effect is all the motion in the universe, all the knockdowns in that domino chain. So what kind of cause could that be? What could pull the whole train? Not just another car, but a locomotive. Not a caused cause, a moved mover, a changed changer, another domino. That would be part of the universe, part of the chain, and just as much in need of further explanation as anything else in the chain. So the first cause of all change must itself be unchanged. And this being has to be real. It can't be something like a Platonic idea or an essence or a concept. These things are unchanging, but they're not things, so they can't cause motion. They have essence, but not existence. So the cause of actually existing things must actually exist. The main weakness of this argument, I think, is not in its premise, but in its conclusion. Obviously, change is real. But what does the argument prove? Does it prove that it's God that causes change, or that there's just some sort of something or other that is unchanged that causes change? If the latter, that's a very thin slice of God and pretty far from the God of religion. A second argument is similar to the first, but begins not with change, but with the very existence of things in the universe. There are two kinds of causality. One kind changes its effect, like pushing down a domino. The other kind brings something new into existence, like manufacturing a domino or conceiving a baby. Both kinds of causality follow the principle that you can't have an effect without an adequate cause. No pop theory. Neither new changes nor new beings simply happen. They have to be caused. So what could cause the existence of everything in the universe? What could be the adequate cause for the very existence of the universe? Nothing can cause itself to come into existence, not even God. That's a logical contradiction. You can't cause yourself to begin to exist because you'd have to exist first before you could do anything. So you'd have to exist before you existed. That is, you'd have to exist when you didn't exist, which is a self-contradiction. So the cause of all existing things must be an uncaused being, a being that has existence by its own essence. Think of existence as a gift passed down the chain of possible beings to make each one actual. Suppose I promised to give you a gift, let's say a certain book, but I first had to get it from my wife before I could pass it on to you, and she had to get it from the librarian before she could give it to me, and the librarian had to get it from another library. Well, unless somebody actually has the book, that book will never be passed down the chain, and you will never get it. But you did get existence. You exist. Why? Because something else that exists, your parents, gave you the gift of existence. Why did they have existence? Not by their own essence, but by a gift from outside, from their parents. Trace this chain back through evolution, back through the history of the universe, until you come to what? If you don't come to a being that has existence by its own essence and doesn't have to borrow it from another being, if you don't come to something that exists necessarily and eternally, rather than being caused to exist by something else, if you don't have such a being, then you don't have an explanation of why the gift of existence is getting passed down the chain right now. So the first argument was, essentially, a squirrel is chasing a nut, therefore God exists. The second one is, essentially, a nut exists, therefore God exists. A third argument begins with the opposite datum, not that things begin, but that they end. Everything eventually dies, even the stars. Everything is mortal. Everything can lose its existence. Everything has the possibility of not existing as well as existing. Now, if there is no God, there is no being that can never die. And if there is no God, there is no creator, no absolute beginning. Therefore, time would have to be infinite. So there would have to already have been an infinite amount of time. But in an infinite amount of time, every possibility would eventually be realized. If I have 1,000 marbles in a jar, some black and some white, and I shake them all up endlessly, combining and recombining them in all possible patterns, it will probably take something like a year before you see a simple pattern like the letters SOS. And if the jar were much larger, let's say 1,000,000 marbles, it would take more time for a more complex pattern to appear. Let's say the first sentence of Hamlet. But eventually it will appear after, say, 1,000,000,000,000 years. Anything that's possible will become actual if there is infinite time and only a finite amount of matter, a finite number of possible patterns or combinations of possibilities. Now, one of those possibilities for everything in the universe is that it ceases to be. And any group of things has the possibility that at any given time all the members of that group cease to be. Well, the universe is the largest group of groups of things, the biggest jar with the most marbles. And in an infinite amount of time, every possibility will be realized, including the possibility of death, not just for one being, but for every being, and not just sequentially, but simultaneously. But once that point is reached, where every being is non-existent, nothing can ever happen again. Once everything ceases to exist, nothing can begin to exist. So, if there is no necessary being, which has to exist, and can never cease to exist, then everything would have ceased, and nothing would now exist. But something does exist. Therefore, there must be a necessary being, a being whose existence is eternal and not losable. Once again, the slice of God, so to speak, that this proof comes up with is rather thin and not personal and not religious, but it would seem to be enough to refute the atheist. A fourth argument begins with the observation that not all things in nature are equal. Some are better, more perfect, in longevity or health or strength or beauty or intelligence or moral goodness. Moral goodness is only one kind of goodness. So things are better or worse, but things can be compared as better or worse only by a standard. Better means closest to the best. More perfect means closer to absolutely perfect. And really better things mean things closer to the really best. If the standard is not real, not objectively real, then our judgment cannot be objectively true. I like dogs better than cats doesn't prove dogs are better than cats. If our standard is only subjective, then we're not really measuring real degrees of perfection at all, only our subjective degree of satisfaction. But if there are really better things, and if really better implies really best, then there must be a really best. If degrees of perfection are real, then perfection is real. But that's another name for God, a really perfect being. A fifth argument begins with the observation that the universe is orderly. The more we learn about the universe through all the sciences, especially astrophysics and genetics and brain physiology and cell biology, the more perfectly calibrated it looks. Many, many different things and parts and dimensions and events and laws all work together to produce a single ordered result. Take the human brain, which is to the world's best computer what that computer is to an abacus. Or take a single human cell, which stores more information than all the books in the Library of Congress. Molecular biologists tend to be theists because the complexity of the design they find there is staggering. Each cell is something like a microcomputer. It almost seems to have a label on it saying, made by superhuman intelligence. And so does the universe. It looks like a giant incubator or a giant womb, exactly calibrated to produce human life. Life could never evolve if any one of thousands of extremely narrow windows of opportunity had closed. For instance, if the temperature of the primeval fireball 3 seconds after the Big Bang had been a trillionth of a degree hotter or colder, it would have been impossible for the universe ever to produce the carbon molecule, which is the basis for all life. Or if our planet were slightly farther from the sun or slightly nearer, or if its axis were tipped a little less or a little more, if there were a little more or less of any one of the wavelengths of light in sunlight, mammals could never evolve. There are hundreds of such variables, all of which together have to be just so, or else we are not so. The probability of all this happening by chance is far, far less than the probability of the same one out of a billion betters winning every single one of a billion lotteries every single day for a billion years. It doesn't take faith to believe that the game is fixed. It would seem to take much more faith to believe that it isn't. But it didn't take modern science to convince people that the universe is full of order. The regularity of the seasons, the generations, the heavens, even primitive chemistry and physics and astronomy and biology sees order in the universe. What's meant by order? The working together of many different parts, each of which has its own nature and its own natural action, to work together for a common end. As the soul or life force or whatever you would like to call it makes all the organs in your body work together for the health of the whole body. When you die, all the atoms and molecules will still be there, but they will no longer work together for the whole cell or cells for their organs or their organs for the body. Each part would fall back into acting simply for itself, like soldiers going AWOL. This argument from order or design is probably the single most popular argument for God. You find it among the most primitive tribes and among the most sophisticated scientists. Order requires an orderer. Intelligent order requires an intelligent orderer. Very, very intelligent order requires a very, very intelligent orderer. Order sometimes does arise accidentally. Once in a million years, the wind and the waves carve out a perfect SOS on a beach. A million monkeys typing at random for a million years on a million typewriters will eventually produce Hamlet, as one famous atheist argued. Actually, a mathematician calculated that it would take something like 1,000 trillion years to produce just the first page of Hamlet. But it could happen. But nobody ever gives that astronomically improbable explanation for anything, except for the universe to avoid God. The instrument you're thinking with right now, your brain, is that chunk of matter which has more complexity and design and order in it than anything else in the universe. It's like a super, super, super mini, mini, mini computer. And that can provide evidence for perhaps an even stronger version of this argument from design. If there is no God, then no divine mind planned and designed you, and your brain evolved merely by chance. Intelligence is a latecomer in the universe, and its causes were unintelligent. So your brain is like a computer programmed randomly by throwing marbles at the keyboard. But do you have any reason to trust it then? Do you trust a computer programmed by chance? Imagine you're on an airplane, and the public address system announces that both the pilots are dead, but the autopilot, is flying the plane, and there's no cause for alarm because this autopilot is a very sophisticated computer which has been programmed by a random fall of hailstones on its keyboard, which was left outside last night in a hailstorm. Do you accept that and trust the autopilot and feel quite calm? But that plane is what your brain is right now, if there is no design in it, if there is no computer programmer, if the forces of evolution don't have behind them some intelligence. If I think as I do merely because the electrical signals in my brain have been caused to move in a certain way by a long, large chain of events that do not include intelligence, a chain that does not go back to an intelligent creator and designer, then it seems I have no good reason to trust my brain, even when it tells me about itself and its electrical signals. These five arguments all began with premises that almost everyone admits to be true. Things change, things come into existence, things die, things are more or less perfect, and things are ordered. Atheists usually admit these premises, with the possible exception of the fifth one, order, but they deny that they logically prove the conclusion of God. Our sixth argument from something in the material universe, the argument from miracles, is just the opposite. Its premise is that miracles exist, and its conclusion is that God must exist. Atheists don't usually deny that the premise would prove the conclusion, but they deny the premise. If miracles happen, then, like everything else, they must have an adequate cause. Even miracles can't violate the law of causality, even if they might violate the laws of physics. If Jesus raises the dead or ascends into heaven, that seems to violate the laws of physics, but even that can't violate the law of causality. There can't be more in an effect than in its cause, its total cause, or the sum total of its causes. So a miracle would be an event in the universe that requires a supernatural cause, that needs something more than the things in the universe to produce it. If I were an atheist, I think I'd spend a lot of time investigating claimed miracles and try to debunk them all. For instance, I'd go to Italy to observe the liquefaction of the blood of St. Januarius, which supposedly happens in public every year on his birthday. That would be concrete empirical evidence for God if it happens. If there are miracles, there's some sort of miracle worker. I don't think we can mean anything sentimental or subjective or squishy here by the word miracles, like sunsets or babies or symphonies. I mean things like raising the dead, or instantly lengthening a shortened leg by 2 full inches just by praying, or living in perfect health for 25 years without ever eating any food except the Eucharist, one tiny wafer of bread each day. If things like that happen, that would seem to be evidence. The question is, do they happen? The atheist denies that they happen, and that requires an investigation of the data, and that's detailed and particular. But a second way, which you can argue about logically, is to admit that events that people call miracles do happen, but to deny that they have a supernatural cause. To admit that science can't yet explain them, but to believe that one day it will. Maybe Jesus really did raise the dead and walk on the water and multiply the loaves and fishes, but that doesn't mean he's a supernatural being, and in a future century, perhaps we will find out how he did it scientifically, and therefore learn how to do it ourselves. Well, perhaps, but it seems to take more faith to believe that than to believe in miracles. A seventh argument is called the Kalam argument. It's about time. It goes like this. If there is no God, there is no creator, and therefore no act of creation, and therefore no first moment of time, so past time must be infinite. But if past time is infinite, present time could never arrive. If the train of today has to come from the station of beginning, which is only 1,000 miles away, it can arrive, no matter how slow it travels. But if there is no beginning, and the track is not 1,000 miles long, but infinitely long, then the train will never arrive. But it has arrived. Today is here. Therefore, there is an absolute beginning, a moment of creation, and therefore a creator. I think this argument has three fairly obvious weaknesses. First, it's confusing. We do not have a clear idea of time. What is time, anyway? If you don't ask me, I know, and so does everyone else, says St. Augustine. But if you ask me, I find out that I don't know, and neither does anyone else. Second, it is similar to Zeno's paradoxes about motion. Zeno was an ancient Greek philosopher who argued that a fast runner like Achilles can never overtake a slow runner like a tortoise, because Achilles has to pass through an infinite number of points in a finite time to overtake the tortoise. Well, we know that Achilles does overtake the tortoise, and that is much more certain than any argument about whether it is mathematically possible. So we know there must be a false assumption in Zeno's argument somewhere, and it's probably the same one in the Kalam argument, treating space and time as discrete, like numbers, rather than as continuous. The third weakness of this argument is that it's not popular because it's too abstract, too mathematical. Its data are not real beings or events, but abstractions like time and today and infinity. Our last three arguments will begin not with physical data apprehended by our senses, but with mental data apprehended by our minds. Yet this data is objective, not subjective. It's not how we think, but what we think. Argument number 8 is the argument from our knowledge of timeless truths. The premise of this argument is the fact that we can know some unchangeable truths with certainty, like 2 plus 2 equals 4, or if A is B and B is C, then A must be C. These truths are not changeable and uncertain like the sky is blue, but unchangeable and certain. 2 plus 2 equals 4 can't ever become untrue. It's timeless and necessary and universal. In all possible worlds, 2 plus 2 must be 4. Two hobbits plus two hobbits are four hobbits, just as certainly as two rabbits plus two rabbits are four rabbits. The laws of physics, for instance, gravity, are not necessary and unchangeable. We can imagine alternatives like anti-gravity, and we can write science fiction stories about them. Many physical laws did, in fact, change during the first few seconds after the Big Bang, for matter itself changed its basic nature. Not so with the laws of mathematics or logic. And even perhaps some principles of metaphysics, like the law of causality. There can't be an effect without a cause, no popping without a popper. Now, where is the reality designated by these necessary truths like 2 plus 2 equals 4? When I know the sky is blue, I'm knowing the sky. What is it that I'm knowing when I know that 2 and 2 are 4? I know where the sky is, it's above the land. Where is 2 plus 2? Obviously, it's not in space. It's an idea. It's not a thing. It's not in something like a box seat at Fenway Park. It's in a mind. But all human minds are changeable, like matter. Statements about human minds, like Jenny knows calculus, are just as changeable as statements about matter, like the sky is blue. Jenny can forget calculus tomorrow, and the sky can become cloudy tomorrow. But 2 plus 2 equals 4 will always be true. So if there are unchangeable truths, and if truths must be in either matter or mind, and if both matter and human minds are changeable, and therefore they can't be the foundation for changeless truths, then some unchangeable mind must be the foundation for changeless truths. If there are eternal ideas, there must be an eternal mind. This argument comes from St. Augustine. Arguments like this from data in the mind are, I think, a lot trickier than arguments like Aquinas's from data in the world. And this one seems to have a built-in problem in it because its premise assumes that these truths known by a mind are objective to the mind that knows them. But its conclusion is not that they are known by God's mind, but that they are in God's mind, subjective to God. Is truth the kind of thing that is in a mind or outside a mind? The answer might be that what is objective to us is subjective to God, because the universe is God's work of art, and the artist's mind creates or invents the truths that he expresses in his art, which is a world that the artist creates. The scientist's mind, on the other hand, discovers truth in a world that's already there. But there still might be a confusion here. God creates things, beings, but he doesn't create truths. Truths aren't things that exist, like rocks. Truths are statements that tell you which things exist. So this argument seems to be treating truths as things. Still another argument from the mind comes from Descartes. Its premise is the fact that the idea of God exists in human minds, even in the minds of atheists. Atheists don't believe the idea is true, but the idea at least occurs. It is the idea of an absolutely perfect being. Now, every event must have a cause, and so the event of my mind understanding this idea must have a cause, and an adequate cause, a cause that has in it enough to produce and explain the effect. For instance, human authors are adequate causes for books, but books are not adequate causes for authors. Now, how much perfection is in this idea? Infinite perfection. And how much perfection is in any natural cause, like a human mind? Only finite perfection. How then could a mentally imperfect being produce a mentally perfect effect? God could dream up the idea of a clever ape, but how could a clever ape dream up the idea of God? If there is no God, why is there such an idea? The idea of a real being infinitely good in every way. The idea seems so remote from everything in this imperfect world that it couldn't be caused by anything in the world. All human minds and desires are imperfect, so how could an imperfect cause produce such a perfect effect? The atheist would answer that we dream of all sorts of things more perfect than ourselves by wishful thinking, and by imaginatively extending our desires towards infinity like a parabola in geometry. Desires like having an immortal father, which is Freud's answer to where religious ideas come from. Or perhaps it comes from our desire to legitimize our economic possessions and oppressions. That's Marx's answer. So the atheist can fairly demand that each of these answers be shown to be inadequate. A final argument, which philosophers today call the ontological argument, comes from St. Anselm in the 12th century. It, too, begins with the idea of God in our minds. Both the atheist and the theist must mean the same thing by the concept of God if they're going to disagree with each other about whether this God exists or not. Now, where's the definition going to come from? Whose definition of the concept of God must we begin with? The believers, of course. In order to be an atheist about Zeus, I have to begin with the Zeus believers' definition of Zeus, because I want to prove that that Zeus does not exist. So how do believers define God? Obviously, you can't define God. You can't enclose an infinite being in a finite definition. But you can say what God is not. God is not imperfect in any way. God is all that is perfect, all that it is better to be than not to be. Anselm's formulation is, God is that than which nothing greater can be conceived. If you can conceive a being greater than X, then X is not God. So far, so good. Now, the question is, does God exist? Just because he exists in our minds as a concept doesn't mean he exists in objective reality, of course. Unicorns and perfect islands exist in our minds, but not in reality. You can't tell whether the thing designated by an idea really exists or not just by looking at the idea. Or can you? Anselm claims there is something unique about the idea of God that makes it possible to do just that in this one case only. For God means the being that lacks no conceivable perfection. But, he goes on to argue, objective existence is a conceivable perfection. Real existence, independent of our minds, is something that it's better to be than not to be. A real unicorn would be more perfect than an imaginary one because it would not be dependent on the mind. A fact is more than a fantasy. A real Santa Claus would be more perfect than a fake one. He could also give you more perfect presents, real ones instead of imaginary ones. But if God didn't exist, then the being that by definition lacks no conceivable perfection lacks this one conceivable perfection, real existence. And that's a self-contradiction. So the argument tries to show atheism is logically self-contradictory. I can conceive a greater God than the atheist's God without existence, namely, that God plus one more perfection, real existence. So that second God, the one with the additional perfection, is the only one that fits the definition of God. If God is not real, God is not God. This is a very strange argument. It seems totally logical, yet it always smells wrong and unconvincing. Its opponents usually point to two weak points in it. Here's the first one. The argument begins with the concept of God, so the word God should be put in quotation marks. But it ends with a real God, a God without quotation marks. It begins with a concept and ends with a reality. But that's ambiguity. It must either begin with a reality and end with a reality, or begin with a concept and end merely with a concept. If it begins with a real God, it begs the question. It assumes what it claims to prove. And if it ends only with a concept, it has proved only that the concept of God includes the concept of real existence, not that God really exists. A second weak point seems to be the hidden assumption that existence is a perfection. Perfections are natures, essences, qualities, designated by concepts, and expressed in logic by terms, terms like wise or beautiful or large. But existence is not an essence. Horses and unicorns both have essences, but only horses have existence. Existence is designated by judgments, not by concepts, and it's expressed in logic by propositions, not terms. God is a concept. God exists is a proposition. Even though this ontological argument has fascinated philosophers more than any other in history, most theists, like Aquinas, for example, do not think it is a valid argument. And good philosophers will not use weak arguments even to prove what they believe to be true conclusions. Unlike many of the arguments for atheism, this argument cannot be even probable. It's either valid or invalid. If it's good, it's the best of all arguments for God. If it's not good, it's not an argument at all. We are only halfway through exploring the case for theism. In the next lecture, we will look at 10 arguments for God's existence from human experience, or psychological arguments.
This ends Lecture 4.